Meg Cranston, we're in the Karsten Schubert Gallery here in London. You have a show here. Perhaps we could walk round it, looking at it, at each piece in turn. At the beginning of the gallery, by the entrance, you have an image of a woman with two what appeared to be fabric horns pinned to her head, and there's a caption underneath her face which says, "There can be no free men until there are free women." The title of the piece is Free Women. Can you talk about this piece?
This one came out of making the paintings that are also in the show, and because I hadn't made a lot of paintings before, I had to experiment. I was experimenting with different strategies of how to get an image going, and this particular piece, it's a really an old poster. You can see it's crinkled up a little bit and so forth, and it's a poster I found in the trash in my studio, and I guess it must be from, looks to be the 70s or late 60s perhaps, the early days of feminism, when I think that a poster like this could be read without irony. And I think since then feminism has become more sophisticated and perhaps, you know, they fought more different kinds of battles. People got, and so in this case, this is a very sweet expression. You know, there can be no free men until there are free women. That's such a fundamental thing. So I thought that to give it a little more of an edge, maybe a more of a 90s toughness, I put horns on her, so she was actually more not so docile. Before she had the horns, she looked really benign, and now she looks more sinister. And there's a moon rising up over her head. So it really gives it a kind of demonic effect. So it was a simple way to make an image.
Formally, just talking generally about the show, the pieces are very disparate in terms of how they are, how they look, the materials they're made from. Are there any concerns that unite the series here in the gallery?
Well, I called the show Some Popular Subjects, and I suppose the idea there, and again, the first works I made were the paintings that we'll talk about soon, was how to make an image and what are the categories of images that are typically of most interest. So I started doing very simple ones, like there's a painting called Some Popular Subjects, Choose Dog's Death, because those seem to be three popular subjects. There's works which are about the self-portrait, which seems to be also a large category. There are several images about famous people, all of whom are recently dead. So melancholia or mourning, that seems to be also a popular topic, along with famous people a la Andy Warhol. So in a loose way, that's what unites them. Although in this show, I was trying to do kind of looser work. I think I started doing this show after my piece in Venice in the Aperto, which was very programmatic. I had determined, I had this piece which dealt with this certain a bit of data. And I'd done a lot of pieces about that, counting and very rigid pieces. And I just wanted to get away from that.
So now you have 10 canvases, 16 inches by 20. And again, as I was saying earlier, formally, even within this series, there's a considerable range of treatments and of ways in which you've dealt with the surface in terms of collaging photostated images, repeated them. But then you've used paint. And again, I get this sense of distance. You're making some sort of statement about the act of painting too. What triggered this series?
I got interested in painting in part because I wanted to do works which I didn't really know what the outcome would be, and I'd done a lot of works where it was already a foredrawn conclusion, you know, how the pieces would look, at least the way they would look. And then I think in part it came out of, I did a show here last year with Karsten, a drawing show, and I'd never shown my drawings before, never really thought of them to be useful except for myself. And then when I saw that show, I said, well, that's okay, you know, maybe I can enjoy myself, making painted and drawn images. So when I approached painting, I didn't really want to come to it with any kind of preconceived idea about what a painting is, although I guess that's always a little bit playing in your head. So I just went at it in a kind of wild way. And I cut out pictures from a magazine or a newspaper and say, well, you know, these seem to go together okay. And I thought maybe by making these paintings I discovered maybe a little bit about what things I'm interested in a formal way rather than just in a purely intellectual way. So I found out things like I started cutting out a lot of ads where the products were arranged very neatly on the page, where there really wasn't a lot of attention paid to making a jazzy design, typically for a department store or whatever. And so there's a painting in front of me that's, and this is the painting I call Some Popular Subjects, Shoes, Dogs, Death. So I just arranged the shoes in a similar way. The background is cloth. Several of the backgrounds are cloth. And really that was, for me, a way to get the painting going. Put something down and say, well, how does that look? And then add a little bit more and a little bit more, because starting paintings is a problem.
Shall we move it along?
Yeah. Well, this one comes up with the title comes in. This was called Some Popular Electronics, and then the organization of this painting was that I cut a lot of ads out from an electronics magazine, so that was the starting point.
We talked about the one with shoes, a dog, and graves in. This one intrigues me, the next one, which is a kind of reminiscent of a 50s textile design, but within it there are images such as the popular chair, fireside chair, and the title of it is called Middle Class Monotony. What were you exploring there?
Well, the two chairs come from, I had to give a lecture at school about on furniture design, and so these two chairs come from one of those books, and I don't know, somehow in L.A. a lot of artists have been getting into kind of this 50s styles, not only furniture, which is not so new, but the shows almost look like that, and I just think they're so deathly. I think that the whole romanticization of, good design in art, and when you walk into an art exhibition and it looks like a fancy, it looks like a boutique. Maybe it's not happening here, but it's definitely happening in L.A. It really pissed me off. So this painting was kind of about that. The monotony of that, and that's the big enemy, anyway, isn't it? To me, is monotony. That's the worst thing about, I think, middle class life. It's monotonous.
So the work, in a way, is not only a critique on ideas about popular culture, but also about perhaps the way in which other artists deal with their circumstances and the imagery they make.
I think so. In this painting, it's kind of the, I think it's a sort of image that these other artists would like. You know, it's not very offensive, it's kind of, I don't know, looks sort of hip, kind of jazzy. I mean, I like it in the sense that it, you know, I know the secret, that secretly it's a critique.
Okay, we'll move to the next one, which is called Psychedelic Experience, and indeed you do have a psychedelic pattern around the edge. But then some cartoon character cut out of white paper.
I hung them together because maybe this is the solution to bourgeois monotony, or one of the solutions people have attempted is through the psychedelic experience. And this, again, this is a poster like the first piece, Free Women, the very old poster, which has now been remade as a lot of kids get back into the 60s thing and wearing tie-dye and psychedelic drugs regain popularity.
If we move now to another piece, in fact, and again, formally this is very different. It's a photographic image, isn't it? 37 inches by 25, called The Tragic Hero of Yorba Linda, oil on gelatine silver print.
Well, the next few that we'll talk about are united thematically. They are all well-known people who died recently, in the last month or two, 2 or 3 months maybe. And so this is a picture of Richard Dixon, and it's called The Tragic Hero of Yorba Linda. That's the place where he's from in California. And it's a photograph of him crying. It's really the picture of Nixon that changed my opinion about Nixon. I grew up and through most of my life thought Nixon is, you know, this horrible person and tricky dick and all these terrible things. Although it didn't change my opinion of him politically, but as a person, this is a picture of him at his wife's funeral his wife Pat's funeral, and he was apparently just devastated by her death. And when he died, people were coming out and saying things about him. One of the reports that I listened to, they quoted Kissinger, and they said, and Kissinger had said that Nixon's life would have been different had anyone ever loved him. And I don't think they mean his family or his wife, but that the press corps and people in general disliked him. He was a disagreeable person and very isolated. So I started, I don't know, maybe having a different, a more sympathetic opinion of him, and I'm calling him a tragic figure because he's this person with this with a tragic flaw that he's can't get along with people or people don't like him. And it's a it comes from Time magazine, American magazine Time, and it's a hand-colored gelatin silver print. And I wanted it to be very romantic, and the frame also to be rather kind of presidential and romantic.
Well, now we're looking at a large photographic print of Kurt Cobain pinned to the wall, and the title here is XL. It's quite a well-known portrait, this, isn't it, of the rock star with a guitar, and all you can see is the long hair in front.
Well, it comes from People magazine, which is, yeah, so it's, at least by now, it's a very well-known, well-known image. Again, I just wanted to do work about, you know, again, this most popular subject, and to present it in a straightforward way.
But again, as with the picture of Nixon and an image around the corner of Kennedy and Onassis, you're actually dealing with popular icons and legends, in a way, of culture.
And also, I was been very interested in the images that different periodicals choose. So there was something about the comparison of how different periodicals represent a tragic event.
As we walk, as being both tragic but also an event that receives an immense amount of popular interest.
Right. Oh, and also the title on the previous one was Extra Large, which is also because he is extra large and he's the biggest picture in here.
Well, now there's a piece which is quite complex that I looked at quite a lot the other evening. The title of it is Women Who Would Play Me If I Paid Them, and it takes the form here in the gallery of three framed sort of modelling shots and a book of letters and so on. But perhaps you could talk about the structure of this piece, how it arose.
Okay. I've done, over the years, several pieces where I try to find a what I call my surrogate pieces. I'll find a photograph of someone who I think looks enough like me that they could substitute for me. Oh, I've done ones where nude ones of myself as a child, but they're always someone else. And so extending that idea, I decided to make a film or a videotape where I would cast an actress, to play me, and she would have to learn to be me using audio tapes, and maybe she'd use this tape, and videotapes. And so this piece is about the first part of that process, the casting process.
What are the underlying concerns, though? What are you trying to explore here by, as you say, creating a surrogate person?
Just, I guess it's about trying to gain self-knowledge. It's a very elaborate way of doing it, by seeing someone else play you or become you. Also, I like the idea that there would be a surrogate that, you know, that could sort of go around and, I don't know, do things that I didn't want to do, or would perhaps become better at being me than I am, so that you could actually get away from yourself just by hiring someone to be you.
Are you the kind of focal point of all these works in one sense or another?
I suppose so. I would hope that my experience or my opinion is shared by other people, so that it doesn't have to be one, you know, it doesn't have to be so specific to me. I think in the case, say, of the Nixon picture, it is about me. It's about a very personal connection I had with this one image, but I think other people share that, and that interests me too, how like mass emotion, mass mourning, how everyone in America, or many, many people in America, were feeling the same emotion over Kurt Cobain, you know, that the media can generate. It's very real, it's very personal, and then I was thinking, like, how many people went to tell their therapist about Kurt Cobain, you know? The most private thing, but everybody's saying the same thing, and it's coming from People magazine.
I don't know where you would locate the important references and the important work of the past that's had some sort of impact or influence on your practice.
I liked pop art a lot. I mean, Andy Warhol had a lot of... You know, I'm a big admirer of Andy Warhol. Conceptual art had a very big influence on me. John Baldessari was my teacher and friend. Though I don't think, I mean, this is the first time I'm using photographs, really, in my work. Artworks never looked similar, but I felt a real association with him and his way of working. So he was important. I mean, conceptual art for me is feels the most natural, because I came to art first studying anthropology and sociology and my involvement with the social sciences, and I was in many conceptual pieces. There's a kind of sociological element and deals with data and dealing with information and how to represent information. So I'd say in contemporary art, that's where I feel most natural. I always liked a kind of real practical approach, you know, like this book piece. Well, just put them all into a folder and allow people to look at them. Of course, on the other hand, I'm also making these paintings, which maybe really is a very different kind of reaction to that really programmatic. I mean, the best conceptual art to me was not so rigid, was more fun and open-ended. I don't mean fun in terms of silly or vacuous subject matter, but I like the energy of it, that possibility of possibilities. Well, why not this? You know, what happens when you drop a bucket of water from this height or that height? And I like that kind of quality of open-ended experimentation, the scientific, I guess, or the quality of it. Actually, I think that where John Baldessari influenced me, that the idea that, you know, it's just, all of them are just ways of making imagery. So whether you, it's in his case, a found film still. I mean, he used them not because I think he was so devoted to film, but because it was practical. I love that practicality of many conceptual artists. And I know many people have said that, oh, your work is so diverse, but to me it doesn't seem that way, because, well, I make this as a painting because this is suited best to painting. And I have pretty clear ideas about things, when I make a sculpture and when I don't. And all of my sculptures deal, most of them anyway, fundamentally with space. Like, how do you, and usually, as I say, this intangible space, the space of self-consciousness, or I made a balloon which contained the amount of air that it would take to read the complete works of Jane Austen. How do you show the space of that amount of time? That's not something I would do as a painting or a photograph, because the subject matter isn't suited to it. So that's how I sort of go from media to media, based on subject matter.
David, could you just begin by describing the basic setup that you've got here for the listening room?
I've got a microphone, various loudspeakers, some amplifiers, and a noise gate. The basics system is microphone plugged into amp, plugged into speakers, turned up to the point of feedback, and the noise gate is in the circuit somewhere. And it's set in such a way that when the signal going through the room, the amount of noise in the room reaches a certain threshold, the noise gate shuts the system off for a bit, till the sound reduces below that threshold again. So basically, it's feeding back. You get, the way I've set it up, you get a low note, or in fact a couple of low notes sometimes, usually a sort of low chord, and a high note. In an empty room, you'll get the high note. Sometimes I kind of adjust it slightly. If I know, like, around about now, it's a kind of 5:45. You tend to get more people in the evenings. I turn it up a bit in the evenings, or rather lower the threshold. on the high end of the thing, so you get more of the high note while there's still people in the space. People usually block it. So the system's reacting to the overall level of noise in the room. If you go in there and shout very loud, it'll stop, for a while anyway. In a static mode, when the room's empty, it stops itself. So these feedback notes, which are the loudest notes in the room, the ostensibly the system's flat. It's a flat amplification across all frequencies. The mic is picking up its own signal from the loudspeakers through the room. The bit of what it's hearing that is loudest to itself through the room is the frequency that's most amplified by the room, which is tends to be one of the resonant frequencies of the room, or a harmonic thereof.
You've talked of the work being sculptural, and clearly I get a sense of that in terms of how the sound physically fills the space of the gallery. But can you talk a little bit more about how you want that to be read or how you want that to be interpreted?
I'm inclined to leave a lot of the readings of it fairly open, and the idea of sculpture is pretty alien to me, but I've always been very fond of Bruce MacLean's use of the word. I really don't like a lot of sculpture, but I like the way Bruce deals with sculpture, the idea of it, and the way he's extended the word. And it struck me that I'm having a similar problem with naming things, in the sense of people say, oh, is this music and is it art or whatever? And it doesn't really bother me which it is. You know, that it's convenient for critics, in a sense, critics of a certain kind of background, to call it this or that. And I don't like calling it installation, for instance, because that's a very sort of tedious sort of idea of a medium. It's neither here nor there. Sculpture is much more, it's a much friendlier term for it. And struck me it was very sculptural in the sense that it was kind of, it used all the air in the room. It dealt with the space in a very particular way, which is something that music, as we know it in Western music, doesn't usually do. Actually, the Western classical tradition, we don't know it from. We know it, of course, from pop music. If you think about a situation where music and pre-recorded sound is kind of reused in an environment, you begin to kind of start describing a rave or something like that. That's something I've been thinking about a lot over the last few years, the reclamation of recorded sound within acid house things and raves and so on. I mean, they're environments I don't feel at all interested in, really. I'm kind of not interested in being there. But I'm interested in the mechanisms that are going on. They seem to display the problems with Western classical music, insofar as it's this kind of proscenium arch defined, very historically defined thing on a stage. And that's a long, long way from any other music in the world. All other music has much, much stronger relationship to the place it happens in. Javanese music, Indian music. Indian music's interesting because of the time of day. You know, for instance, a raga is intended for a specific time of day. So there's a very strong sense of location in that kind of music. You know, sometimes it's a ceremony, sometimes it's a time, sometimes it's a place. And also in non-Western music, the players react to the place much more. They're allowed to. They're part of the audience very often. And I'm sort of interested in the mechanisms that drew Western music outside of that. I'm also interested in watching the mechanisms that draw it back to that. And working in music kind of professionally as a pop musician and also kind of as a semi-classical producer with Michael Nyman and so on, I was becoming very, very aware of the disparities in attitude that were going on. You know, the fact that everything released on Decca Classical has this same idealized kind of blanket echo on it, this kind of, La Scala kind of reverb or something, It's actually idealized and based on some specific concert hall, I suspect. In a curious way, when I did Drowning by Numbers with Nyman, Greenaway had, for the Mozart section, he had a record of... which orchestra was it? It was Bath Festival, anyway. And I happened to have the same orchestra from the same Bath Festival with Menuhin doing Tippett's Concerto for Double String Orchestra. And I really, really liked the sound of that record, which is very much the sound of the room. It was recorded in. The Mozart was recorded in the same room. I spent a long time on Drowning by Numbers actually getting a very, very similar sound to the sound of that Mozart recording or the Tippett recording, to give the thing some kind of... just an interesting space for it to be in, maybe. And that was the sort of... That was the start of a kind of thinking with recording Nyman's music in particular, where he was writing more and more romantically instead of this hard stuff that we started with. And I wanted to kind of pull back the microphones and pull back all the screens and get rid of the click tracks that you use for film music and so on, and just have the musicians playing in his space. And it got to the point where, come the Uta Lemper record, which is more or less the last one I did with him, it's all recorded in kind of ambient mics up near the ceiling. Very little close miking used in the final record. And you're hearing the sound of the room. This piece came about quite specifically from University of East London, who had their time-based arts students on a placement in Newham Leisure Centre, down in E14, I think it is. And they got me in for a day, and I brought along my noise gate, because I had a kind of vague sense of, you know, moderating the thing in some way. And something very, very close to this installation was assembled within about half an hour with the students. And later I kind of went back to Newham with the equipment, with almost my own equipment, and did a series of recordings of it, which ended up being used as a kind of tribute to Cage on a Japanese CD. And the piece is kind of... I stick with it as a sort of something that I keep finding out more and more about it. So, you know, there's the sculptural aspect, there's the musicological kind of side to it. And also, I suppose what's unusual in my work, perhaps, is that I'm dealing with an audience. Working primarily with recordings for a long, long time now, I've avoided and hidden from audiences to a great extent.
It's interesting that you mentioned Cage there, the use of that as a kind of tribute to Cage, because he's someone who comes to mind very immediately when you walk into the space. Again, I suppose he would be a figure who would be relevant when one's choosing not to distinguish in terms of categories whether this is sculptural or musicological or whatever, but it combines aspects of both. And what seems to be important is the relationship between the space of the room, the volume of the room, the air that's in it and so on, and the sense of the body. And those two particular harmonics that you get, the very low and the very high, recall that idea of Cage's when you go into the silent room, the total room, what you hear is your blood and your nervous system going, one very low physical sound in the body and the very high one.
That actually came up in conversation last night. And a lot of those kind of references have been coming up when people talk to me about the piece. And yes, it's all there, I suppose. And I wouldn't really know how, in what way to kind of qualify that. The idea of compositional identity in Cage's work is almost non-existent. Yet a Cage piece is immediately recognisable because of the nature of its performance and so on. What it has got a very strong identification with is the place it's performed in, which brings us back to what I was saying about non-Western music. And Cage is perhaps the first person in Western music to kind of regain that. And I think, you know, other people have done it since. Alvin Lucier did it. Even Philip Glass recognised it. It's a sleeve note to Music in 12 Parts when it was originally released, where he talks about the amplification of the sound being absolutely essential to the kind of the way the music works in the space. The very high levels of amplification, or comparatively high levels of amplification he was using in those days, certainly louder than anyone else on that kind of scene. And, you know, that's a comment which is very, very comparable to the kind of things that Rhys Chatham and Glenn Branco were saying subsequently. And that those kind of concerns with the space, the music's in, the place the music's in, that's a common thing.
Is there another way in which one could identify a kind of a reference here to Cage 2, which is that of the idea of random structure? Because although you've set up the sort of formal conditions in this piece, you can't control the way in which people come in and the noise that they make and whether the place goes silent. So there is a sort of a random element to the work.
There is, but it's much more limited, I think, than it might appear. You know, the parameters are actually fairly strict. The resonant frequency of the room won't change unless someone knocks down one of the walls. So if I'm prepared to say, well, sometimes the gaps between the low notes are longer than other times, and sometimes you have a high note there, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have a kind of quite extraordinary sound, but that only lasts for usually one cycle. Within those parameters, it's actually not going to change very much. So there's not kind of underlying structure which survives what anyone does within the space, pretty much.
How specific were the ways in which you installed it here? I mean, was it pre-planned, or did you have to spend a lot of time experimenting with microphone location, loudspeaker positioning? Because it's a very distinctive space, this Chisholm Hill Gallery.
I had a fairly definite idea. I wanted to use the length of the space, being that being the greatest distance. And the Chisholm Hill was good enough to allow me a week in August to just practice, mess around, try things out, did a lot of different speaker positionings and mic positionings, different kinds of microphones, all sorts of things. And a couple of days into this, I had it up and running in a completely different configuration with different speaker placement, and it really annoyed me that it didn't sound good, that the high-end stuff was internally very, very out of tune with the low stuff. And I couldn't figure this out at all till Jonathan Watkins told me that one of the long walls, the long wall on the street side of the gallery, is a stud wall, which explained it all then. The low note was bouncing right through the structure of the building. The wall is transparent to the low frequency, whereas the high frequency is bouncing off the stud wall. So they're dealing with two different spaces. And I've got round that now somehow, just by kind of repositioning and listening. But there was that kind of major problem. It really felt very uncomfortable. And I'm not one of these people who goes on about, you know, just intonation and Pythagorean theories of tuning and all that stuff. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, generally things sound a lot more interesting when they're out of tune. But in this case, it went from being, and I think it's comfortable. People have said it's comfortable. Some people say it's spiritual. In the current version, it was definitely very uncomfortable and just sort of annoying, really, in the other version. Like, you know, feedback is normally annoying when it kind of, you know, when someone walks on stage and they go to the microphone and it goes like that, you know. It's annoying in those kind of situations. And I guess I was kind of looking more towards the more positive aspects of that sound.
Right, Stan, you've just done a long gallery talk, so I hope I won't just go over a lot of the stuff that you've already talked about today. You have in the show at the ICA three large-scale works. There's Orchon, which is the double projection screen piece that was shown a couple of years ago also in Documenta. There is the piece Pursuit, Fear, Catastrophe, Ruskin, BC, which is a large silent film and music piece using a piece of Schoenberg, and the new piece that you've just done for Chicago Evening, which is a three-screen projection, looking at ways of presenting news on television. One of the things that I'm very interested in when looking at all of those works is that there seems to be running through them all a sense in which you try to defy resolution. In Orchamps, there is on one side of the screen an edited film of a free jazz session, but on the back we have all of the outtakes presented at the same time. In Evening, there are three simultaneous bulletins looking at the same set of issues. And in Pursuit, Fear, Catastrophe, you're using a piece of music by Schoenberg, which in its atonality is, again, as it were, without a particular place, without a tonal resolution. Is this something that is very important for you?
I suppose so, in that narrative sense you describe, but also in sort of more overriding, an overriding image in all pieces is sort of one of absence. Something is missing. In the narrative in Ruskin, there's that missing character who you see the back of early on in the film, and people are having their, like the cops and his roommate are have their conflict about throughout the film, but he's never seen later in the film. And of course, with the piano itself, there's the phantom pianist with the dropping keys, and there's nobody there playing it on that grand piano. In Orchamps, there's the idea that with these two cameras, you have a complete view of the field of the event that's going on. Supposedly with the back side of the screen, you're getting a more complete notion of what the event was like, but still there's more that was going on. So there's a further outside to the Orchamps of what's presented. So often I describe the image of the pieces somehow taking place on the filament between those two images. The images are shown back-to-back on a plexi screen, and it's sort of the event is in the cuts and somewhere in between there. And of course with what's shown in Evening, which is the transition from, for want of a better expression, straight news to happy talk news in the U.S., the ancestor of most broadcasting conventions today, the biggest absence is what they're talking about. It's the focus on the reporters, their style of delivery, the whole theatrics of news broadcasting at the expense of a sort of expansive form of representation. Representation which is always, to a certain degree, tautological or self-obsessed, but this took it to a wild extreme for political reasons, I think.
With that piece, Evening, you say, as it were, that the content is absent, that we're witnessing much more this style, this happy talk style of presentation. To what extent is what Happy Talk is replacing simply another frame within which that content was also absent?
One thing that Happy Talk was for, I think, was to be able to avoid actually dealing with the issues of the day. There was the war in Vietnam. This is like news in Chicago. The war in Vietnam, the Chicago 7 trial, the assassination of Fred Hampton. These were very hard things for people to deal with editorially because they could have very explosive results. So almost hysterically, I think that these things were, styles of delivery were invented as a way of being able to say what the subject was, what the issues were, what events had happened, but not dealing with them, not providing a continuity, not saying this event happened today, this is what it means relation to the past, not taking that an editorial stand which could be challenged from either the right or the left in Chicago. They wanted to have it both ways. So it quite clearly stopped the pretense of objectivity or even editorial bias, but went into a different realm of this sort of self-obsessed, tautological manner of presentation.
The way that you've dressed the sets in that piece, behind each of the newscasters, there is predominantly a red, a green, and a blue background. This seems quite straightforwardly to be a signal to the audience to look at the technology that is delivering them, the messages that they're receiving. This is something that's obviously very important to you in all of the pieces, and this also seems very clear in these shorter pieces, these 15, 30-second pieces, the monodramas and the television spots, which are modelled in very many ways on adverts and are shown on network television precisely in those locations. But they also, I think,
seem to do, which you talk about quite often, is to interrupt the flow, as a, in a sense, to try and pull us out of the way that this medium is just seducing us in some sense. Is this right?
Well, there is the whole practice of the Brechtian practice of bearing the device, which happens to a certain degree, but there's a way in which the narrative forms themselves also bear the device. In a very sort of clear way, I've made one station having a bias towards red, one towards green, one to blue for RGB of the TV tube. But that was actually how most stage design was done for TV in that period. If you look at old Star Trek or Get Smart or something, which are sort of preserved in Technicolor film stock, you see that they were designed the sets on the basis of the TV primary colors, because they had the most resolution on still sort of dodgy technology that was happening there. So I just took that same approach and used that for structuring the entire thing. With regard to the TV spots and the monodramas, it basically there's sort of an overriding allegory, I suppose, of what's happening inside the pieces themselves and their situation on TV, and being transitional spaces, spaces that are forgotten but are nevertheless crucial to, on one hand, everyday life, on the other hand, to TV broadcasting in North America, but of course the use of different idioms. Made-for-TV movies, advertising, sort of soap opera conventions are other things as well, which I try to employ in those pieces.
In all of them, too, music is very important. You use that one session of free jazz in Auchan, which is a kind of reconstruction of a late 60s, early 70s session with American musicians transplanted to Paris. There is the Schoenberg in Pursuit Fear Catastrophe, and also the way in which you talk about your scripting of evening, where the three newscasters begin with this unison good evening and then go off and, as it were, solo with pieces. Could you say a little bit about that, the importance of music within your work?
Not much more beyond what you said with evening. It's sort of it is music. There is the use of music in these other pieces, but then trying to make that the structuring model for the writing the script for evening. But yeah, of course music has been very important for me for what I regard as a very clear-cut representation of how people deal with time and with other people. I mean, if you look at music in its in most basic forms are the relationship of various voices over a period of time, and how do these people want to inhabit the same period of time together. That's why I sort of can't stand symphonic music, because I can't stand the sound of people playing in unison to replicate a sort of higher voice. But ensemble music I find, you know, very interesting for the... is it going to be with one dominant voice and subordinate voices, as it is in, say, a concerto, or is it going to be somehow a collaboration or a communication, as it typically is in the jazz form, taken to... a very extreme point in free jazz, obviously. And this whole project of performance craft is something that has been crucial for jazz music, but it's something which disappeared from European music. European music had been an important part of it had been improvisation and ensemble performance until the invention of the canon around the turn of the century, but that has disappeared. And somehow, since the invention of recording, we've stopped seeing European musicians improvising until the 60s, when they tried to revive certain ideas of that performance craft. But for jazz, it has still been allowed to have that freedom until, I guess, Wynton Marsalis, which sort of has gone back and has been trying to construct a musical canon, which has become almost as ossified as the classical one.
You mentioned in a recent interview that you did with Lynn Cook that you were working on something for London. Was that simply in relation to the preparation for this show, or were there particular pieces that you had conceived?
Well, I had written 8 scripts for TV pieces for London, all set on the tube, and sort of like a psychogeography of London based on who gets on and who gets off the Victoria line on a certain given day. But I've sort of been trying to rethink that whole project of these broadcast works. and trying to understand the audiences in greater detail. And I don't really believe I knew that the British audience or the British conventions well enough to actually work here without any, you know, spending more time doing research.
That aspect of having an audience in mind for your work, is that always something that's quite clearly there? I mean, you've mentioned in the past, for example, that the piece Orchamps would be familiar in terms of the way in which it's shot to people who grew up with sure. French television in the 60s and know the style. That piece Evening, for anyone who lived in Chicago, as you say, some of the actors are actually people who've done yeah. news broadcast there, so they would have a completely different kind of take on it to sure. an English audience that is experiencing it now.
And that's why I have those clumsy texts with the installation, sort of giving some background as to what these certain references are. I think there's something reasonably transparent in the works based on those conventions that have become, not exactly global, but in the Western world, well-known in terms of TV and filmmaking. But there are specific things which are very local and always going to be local to either film or television media, which are important to important differences to respect. And I just want to, by those texts, allow people access to that local vernacular.
There's also a very kind of physical aspect to the viewing of many of the pieces, particularly the large-scale gallery pieces. Mm-hmm. With Evening, you have these three cones, sound cones, mm-hmm. from the ceiling, so that the audience can move from one to the other to get a particular
sure.
Output, or you can move around the room and have all of them playing at you together. Yeah. With Orchamps, you're running backwards and forwards from one side of the screen to the other. That is part of, as it were, the constitution of the meaning of the work.
Yeah, the question always is how to realize in sort of concrete form these relationships, how to make a model of these relationships of media, of its ill communication in space, and that's what these installations try to achieve to a certain degree. Try to organize the polyphony of different, say, ideological takes on the news from represented by those three channels, which are simultaneously possible to be received. Try to find a way to. I was trying to find a way to script that and to manifest that. With Orchamps, how do you present the fact that there's always going to be an alternative, always an alterity? So it always lets you know that there's always the back side or the front side, the other side, which you don't have access to. There's always an alternative to which you don't have access.
Do you think of that always as being, I mean, to use a jargon word, a kind of dystopic fact about these things, that the truth is, as you say, in the kind of filament in between those two screens, that the truth of the news behind the news is in the gaps as you leap from one to the other, and so on. The way that you've used Schoenberg's own scenic descriptions, mm-hmm. fear, pursuit, catastrophe, yeah. pursuit, and so on, as one way of describing what happens in any kind of narrative, I mean, rather than say, I don't know, imagination, construction, and resolution, or something like that. That there's always some kind of failure at the end in your attempt to, or in one's attempt. I don't mean you personally. I mean in one's attempt to.
Well, we're a long way from the Enlightenment and a long way from high modernism. Realize that these supposedly unifying systems of knowledge are always excluding something. And my work has been an attempt to address the outside.